Hey, Pronouncers, welcome back to another episode. We're really excited to have you back. Thank you so much for listening. We are here every Thursday. I'm your host, Bruce from Printavo. We've got Stephen Farragut at Campus Inc. and Mr. Matt Marcotte out of Printavo HQ, a.k.a. his basement.
Yeah.
Are you in the basement, Matt?
Always. It's my dungeon. They lock me down here.
How's your flood, Matt?
All better. That was
really? They fixed it? You had a pretty bad... Chris, we're going to have to queue up the video right here. Matt can send it to you.
Mm-hmm. But it was an unplanned water feature in our front room. Yeah, we got real, real lucky. I'll be completely honest. So my stepson, he decided shower time. He said he wanted to take a bath. That's fine. He's 8. He can run his own bath. So you know where the overflow drain is in your tubs, at that little like silver disc? Well, for those of you who don't know, that silver disc, the very bottom underneath it, it's actually open. And so when the water level gets to that, it drains into your tub drain to make sure your tub can't overflow. Well, looks like when they installed that overflow drains as a new house, they didn't connect it correctly. We didn't know that was the issue. He took a bath and I was down here on a call and like 8 o'clock, went upstairs and there's just water coming from our ceiling, just like drip, drip, drip all over the place. So I drill holes. We had a couple buckets down. I had a good 4 or 5 inches of water in these buckets just from my ceiling. Not good. So called the builder. He came out the next morning with a plumber, and they started cutting open the ceiling drywall. And
it's a feature, Matt, not a bug.
It's a feature, right, not a
exactly.
bug.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it was part of the build. Oh, water feature in your living room. That's normal. The aftermarket mold's going to really help, right? So we did some hunting. I turned off the water, so we didn't have water in the house for a good, like, 16, 17 hours. So getting ready in the morning without running water, you forget how dependent you are on such a simple thing. But we figured out that was the issue after a good like 2 to 3 hours of trying to figure out what the issue was, because he was like, oh, it couldn't be that. So we just didn't even look at that. That was it. So it was actually a pretty quick fix for the plumber to actually go in. We cut the ceiling open anyway. So he went up there and changed the pipe size, reseated it. We've got a bunch of big holes in my...
Standard procedures now for taking a bath? Like, don't fill it up past this line?
Oh, we totally scared the crap out of him. We brought him down. We're like, look what you did. He's like, oh, God. I'm like, I'm kidding. It actually worked out pretty well because we have a one-year warranty in the house, and we moved in August of last year. So because it was in that 1 year, it was 100% covered by the builder's warranty.
Bruce, how's the warranty going on your water problems in Chicago?
Nice. Yeah, we've got a water feature also. Comes with the house. It's a nice irrigation system, drip, drip. It's pretty bad. I feel like every homeowner, though, has some sort of water story. As I've come to, it's almost like a dad chat. You know, people are on the lawn and just chit-chatting back and forth on the weather or whatever small talk there is. And then water comes up and everybody's like, oh, you should have saw last year. And it's just, ours is also never ending, it seems. There's been 4 different spots, but
if you own a home in Chicago, you probably have water problems.
Well, yours is a condo too, right? So how does that land on you and not the condo association?
Because Bruce is the condo association.
It is the condo association on the roof. Right, coming from the roof it is. But because it's inside my unit, you know, it's 3 people in this building. So it's what's called a 3-flat in Chicago. There's just 3 condo units on top of each other. But what are you going to do? Like, I'm technically the president of the HOA association. Downstairs is the treasurer who collects the HOA payments. And that's it. So, yeah, I
charge
have to
yourself more,
do
Bruce.
Something about it.
Did you raise your rates?
Yeah, we need to get on the premium 349 plan.
There's Zapier integrations with that one.
Mm-hmm.
So
power schedule coming for the water feature soon.
Before we jump too far in here, first thing, I got so many text messages about the Alex Phelan Teespring story. I don't know if you guys watched that one that we recorded with him. Crazy, crazy story, especially when he gets to the part we're talking about black hoodies. We'll drop a link down below too if you haven't watched it. But, you know, black hoodies just completely soaking up the whole inventory of them across the nation. You know, growing, doubling every single month for a couple of years. I mean, just like nuts growth. Steven on Short Show. That was awesome. I listened to it.
I haven't listened to that one yet. I love you, Steven. It's hard to keep up with all the different things. It's on my queue.
There's
for
literally
next.
Only two podcasts
Look,
in the industry.
Podcast life Matt. Means you have to support other podcasts or relevant
there's
ones.
There's two podcasts in the industry.
There's more.
Are there more?
I mean, I think there's more. I think you're cutting out a lot of people there. But are you saying that really? it's just Short Show
who
and
else,
us?
Who else posts regularly? Not in a negative way. I'm just saying I don't think there's any other people that I know there's people that have started and then stopped. There's a lot
yeah,
of really cool vlogs and like YouTube, videos and things going on in people's shops.
I just have a hard time with the 3-hour episodes. Was yours 3 hours, Steven?
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. We hung. It was great.
That's the hard. I'm not working in a shop every day anymore where I'm like just like grinding and can like listen. I'm nerding out with Printavo folks all day and talking to users, so it's hard for
well,
me to and, set aside.
Andy and Dylan, if you're listening to this, just go ahead and delete Matt's episode.
Just delete it. Just go ahead and delete it.
You know, I thought just it was longer him. Too, but it when I get up about a third of the way through, I was like, oh, this is, you know, it ramped up. But it was interesting. There was a couple topics. I actually wanted to bring something up. You guys got into question of growth and long-term thoughts and like, you know, what you want long-term or if you even know what you want long-term. And there was like a big discussion of are you growing it to keep growing it? Are you growing it to be more profitable and satisfy your lifestyle? Are you growing it to sell it? It seemed like nobody really knew, but did you have any changes from what you had talked about in that episode, Steven?
It's always a question that it's hard to answer, right? Andy said it best, for a certain price, everything is for sale.
Mm-hmm.
We joked about it a couple weeks ago. If Jeff Bezos knocked on our door, we're all for sale. Sure. Mm-hmm. You'll write us a blank check. Yes. And I guess it's at what point is that number worth it to you? Are you ready to A, move on to something else, or B, you've now packaged your business up and the prize is that, wow, someone's actually going to buy this thing that you've built. But when you get the question, Bruce, it's like, you know, it's probably like the question like, Bruce, you know, when do you want to have kids? You know, I don't know, Bruce, like how would you answer that? Right. It's a question that maybe, I don't know, Bruce, how would you answer that?
Chrisette actually asked me about this yesterday, and that's why I bring this up. It's a good question. I find that what's difficult is everybody who started a business started it because of that mentality, you know, to grow or be on their own or whatever. And I think the question is, when does that stop? And I feel like it doesn't stop until you are physically stopped from investing more into it. And maybe that's because of a growing family. Maybe that's because you're just tired. But there's something that shifts it later. Or else, you know, when is enough enough? I don't see anybody who really started a business that would say, I'm a good here until they hit some sort of point. I think there was some event that happened. Maybe they got exhausted or whatever happened that pivoted off that says, actually, I'm good here.
I have a hard time picturing either of you stopping, knowing you both as well as I do. I have a hard time picturing you both. Like if Bezos showed up tomorrow with a check and bought it, I'm sure you'd go for it. But I can't imagine what like 2 to 3 weeks later would look like for either of you. Like you could probably take a minute and chill, but I think you'd both go crazy not having your outlet of running your companies and like being all into that. It'd be really interesting to see
you would totally want to start something else. But I think the question is, are businesses in our industry sellable? Like, are they transferable? Are they at a point where they're actually worth something? And I think that's a hard question to answer because most often the owners are the operators and they're such an important part of the business that when you remove them, you're like sucking lifeblood out of the business and the business could turn into nothing overnight. You know,
with print shops especially, I've seen that a lot where shops like, oh yeah, I'm selling or I'm getting taken over by somebody else, we get a nice buyout, And that customer base doesn't retain, right? Once that sale happens, you lose at least usually a third. And then from there, most of the time it was relationship build. So when I see on Facebook, like, oh, I'm selling my book of clients, I'm always really, really hesitant about that because that doesn't mean they're going to stick with you. There's no guarantee they're going to stay. So it's a good point, Steve. I don't know if a lot of print shops really are sellable unless they get to like a massive scale where it's just kind of set and repeat. But for most shops, it's really the relationship with the owner or whoever's in charge that kind of helped foster that business.
Yeah, I think if the owner is involved to the day-to-day and they play such an important role to that, your business isn't really worth much.
It's a risk to the buyer, for sure.
It's a risk to the buyer, right? And so really, your business is worth the equipment at liquidation value, right?
In some sort of multiple of probably sales, but it doesn't have to be a multiple up. It could be down, too.
It could be like
50% of...
Right. It could also be junk work that you don't want. I've seen some huge shops that are, you know, doing so much contract printing on pennies that are just spinning their wheels.
Been there.
So I think it's a hard thing to think about, but I think shops should always start thinking about, like, what's the exit strategy? Is it a transfer to a younger owner? You know, like in my shoes, there was kind of a succession plan. Is it to a child? Is it to employees? I've heard and I've seen, because the last thing you want to see your business do is fail after you leave it, right? But at the same time, you don't want to be tied to it forever. That's like a shackle. That's a shackle, literally. And I think that's, you know, in our industry, I think we're starting to see that as older owners are saying, okay, what do I do? What do I do? And that's why there's this huge need to say, okay, how do I automate? How do I hire VAs? How do I turn this into a little bubble that I can watch instead of like be inside every day?
I think the thought is, can you grow to a point where you are an owner and not an operator? Because there is definitely a gray area of you just have to do everything. And then, you know, you hire people to take things on, but then you really don't get there until I think you have actual managers managing contributors that you can step back a bit and be more of an owner and have probably a better lifestyle that you had imagined early on. But that, I mean, it could be 10 years.
I was just talking to Adam about this, who's going to be, you know, a partner of ours, but we were talking a little bit about burnout and owner's burnout. And we've ventured into this new part of our business where we're doing a ton of Shopify and big brand management and stuff. And it's awesome. It's extremely hard. It's extremely taxing. And I was just kind of saying, like, we make a mess, we clean it up, we automate it, and then we figure out the next thing. And so, you know, I was kind of showing him, hey, we're like 4 to 5 months out from really automating this piece of our business. And I know you're playing such an imperative role on the day-to-day of it, but there's a bigger picture. But what I was saying is you have to get to a point where you could take a month off and that part of the company can run. And until you're at that point, then you're not sustainable yet. And you're going to feel that burnout. You're going to feel overextended. You're going to feel like you're doing payroll at night, taxes in the morning, and then putting out fires all day. And that is not sustainable. That is not a healthy entrepreneurship, you know, entrepreneur's
lifestyle.
But
you can also kind of be a little more patient when you are part ownership, right? So you talked about like having a succession plan or having employees that are also part owners, have equity in the business. I think that goes a long way when you own a small piece of the pie, even a small piece, right? It's on you to help make sure it succeeds. And I think that definitely helps drive. I mean, Stephen, if you weren't the owner, one of the owners, right, would you be working half as hard as you are? Probably not. You'd be working on 3 or 4 other things that would occupy your mind and your need to do something. So I think having people own something, even a small percentage of it, can really do a lot. So I'd be curious to see how many shops out there actually have some sort of like equity plan of saying, hey, you are part business owner in this. Let's try to ramp you up. Because I think that would definitely have a lot of help with getting them to knuckle down, do the work, and actually understand there was a plan to execute and not just show up day in and day out and just clock in and clock out.
You know, I might disagree a little bit. I was actually talking to Jed a little bit about this, and he said, you know, bars do this a lot, where like they'll take the GM who they really like and say, all right, you're an owner now. You better be here all the time from open to close to 3 a.m. to whatever. And then all of a sudden the building needs a new roof or the air conditioner goes out Well, you just gave that person equity, and now you're going to say, hey, I need you to come pay for this, or you have to come help me out with this. I don't know if it's up to the employees to necessarily have to deal with that or have to be invested in that, because you could also dangle a carrot out that never pays off, right? I think it might even be better to have really, really strong like KPIs, a really strong tracking system and a scoreboard and metrics, and then incentivizing your team and rewarding them, right? So if it's your production manager, it's, you know, on, you know, cost of goods and profitability and output, and making sure there's like really good bonus involved. I was talking to Bruce about this, like in the trading world, stock traders and people that work in fintech, I mean, they're paid out huge bonuses totally based on performances, and oftentimes they never own a piece of the company, but they're well tracked and well compensated. I don't know. Bruce, what do you think?
You know, it's interesting. When I first tried to implement Traction, I gave everybody a different number, and we talked about that number every single week in our weekly meetings with that department. And people, after the second or third week, began to talk about their number like it was their little baby almost. And specifically on customer care, there's two metrics. One is average customer response time, and then we also said answered phone calls to total phone calls received ratio. And people would bring these numbers up again and again, like, oh, shoot, but that's going to hurt first response time. What do you think? Is that okay or not? And when people started to bring that up, it was really interesting because they did care a lot about it. But I do think for us in the software world, there's pieces, I feel like, of a pie to create strong employee motivation. Part of it is that ownership aspect. Part of it is the freedom and autonomy to like do stuff that they find is valuable. I think part of it is definitely compensation. I mean, we are in a competitive space. And so, and then part of it is we did create like an equity pool for, you know, Matt and for everybody else at Printavo to participate in. That equity doesn't mean anything, truthfully, unless the company, you know, bonuses out distributions or something, like purchases it back, or somebody purchases the company, or technically if it goes public. I don't think we're doing that. So
Printavo IPO.
but like my thought was I did want everybody to think more aligned, as so when you have three options, you know, of what should I be doing today, that you're very aligned with the same motivation that I'm thinking of. Is it perfect? No, but you know, I thought that slice of giving out was worth more as we continue to grow the company. That was our thought. But the other side is we are also in a very competitive world with engineering talent and hiring technical talent. And so you just, you do have to offer quite a bit to attract good people. But it's interesting. Like, for sure, it's interesting to think about. I mean, you were doing some of the bonus stuff, though. Do you still do that with mistakes specifically? You had like the bonus jar?
So I think there's a point in what's like middle management. And that's, I think, where shops struggle a lot, is creating that tier of middle management. When I was middle management, I was having to play a ton of like iterated games with different departments to say, okay, marbles in the jar for good prints, mistakes take marbles out, bonuses, S&S bucks, all that. Because I didn't have the ability to track everything day by day, and I would have to just like put something there, go try something else over here. You know, I was constantly running around in circles. I think in the last year, post COVID, or since, you know, we've had the reset button, we've made a conscious decision to hire middle management. Really, really trained professionals that have experience from other industry that were managers elsewhere and that can bring to the table more than I can do. Right. And so we draw on, you know, Justin, who's worked for us, who came from hospitality. You know, yeah, he needs to learn about printing and, you know, the technical side of it. But as far as conflict resolution, dealing with customers, keeping the guys there, having a happy shop, cooking out on Fridays, you know, making sure everything's buttoned up in the shop, he's the reason that I don't have to be there every single day. And that's where I'd say, all right, Matt, I need you to help Justin learn the technical side. But Justin brings the soft skills of just being a great people person, you know, and he keeps the peace there. And if there is a fire, he's on it. You know, we were shipping a pallet to Arizona and he was dealing with, you know, the LTL and everything. And, you know, he wasn't done until it was delivered. And that was just, I was like, wow, what would happen if I had to do that right now? So I think it goes to say, like, you know, your shop's only sustainable if you have really good managers. And if you are the manager, I don't know if your business is necessarily sustainable, because if you remove yourself from it, it doesn't rock the same way, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, not yet. Did you guys do any bonus structure at Second City Prints, Matt?
Kind of. The great end of the year bonus structures and things like that based on different performance. A lot of that was more for the middle management. There really wasn't when it came down to like the standard employee. I would just do reviews every couple of weeks and like kind of give them goals I wanted them to hit. And then that would kind of affect their end of year raise and their bonus structures. But as a manager, yeah, we did have different KPIs we had to hit, and then we hit bonus structures from that. So yeah, we definitely did. And then when I ran Target, we definitely did that through. We had like 100 employees, so had to go through and really put a plan together to keep everybody around, keep them happy. A lot of hard to hit goals that if they hit, they'd get rewarded very handsomely, but oftentimes it all fall a little bit short. So I could kind of toggle down what that bonus would actually be.
Question for you, because I'll get questions from shops saying like, how do I track this? How do I track commission? How do I track waste? How do I track spoilage? How do I track how fast they're printing? At those shops that you ran that were pretty large, y'all tracked a lot of stuff. How much of it was manual?
I mean, most of it, to be completely honest, and almost all of it.
That's the light bulb that has to go off in small shops. Tracking is manual work. There's not some program that's just going to track everything for you. No, you're going to need to run pivot tables every week. You're going to have clipboards out there. You're going to have manual work. And if you think it's hard, you're losing money by not at least trying to track it, right? Like at least trying to get a metric. You know, we listened to Michelle Moxley when she talks about what they did, you know, at the factories of waste. And it was a lot of manual tracking. But the data you pull from it is so powerful. And so I think if a shop's listening to this, it's, you know, pick one thing or two things that you can track that are easy to track, or like you could easily write out a 5-step to how to track it and start just like keeping a point. It might even be, you know, what your M&R says every day for impressions or prints.
Right? I mean, I would have end of the day, I'd have to go around, look at every press, write down the numbers. I'd have temp people I'd hire in and have them just sit there and with stopwatches and time things, watch somebody else and time things, pay them $12-13 an hour to sit there for the entire day and just notate things like, thanks for the day, you're good, send them home after that, and just try to get as much data as you could. Then exactly what you said, just go ahead and put it in a spreadsheet, start analyzing it, evaluating it, figuring out where you can increase production, cut waste, cut time, all that stuff. But most of my day jobs at those places were, of course, handling the people, keeping them happy, moving things around, and then just collecting data, looking at it, and trying to figure out how to maximize efficiency and move forward. There definitely wasn't enough automation. I mean, especially, I mean, we're talking 2010. 2010 is when I first started running that shop. I was there for 5 years. A lot of the stuff we have today, Zapier, all that stuff, that wasn't even really a thing yet. So a lot more that had to be manual than I think it could be now.
Bruce, you've been to a lot of big shops, right? And you've met with owners of some massive shops. What are they doing on a day-to-day?
It's interesting. So there's one really large one we've been working with here that I've just been honestly going to learn from a ton. The owner is not like technical screen printer. He's very good salesperson. He's a very good relationship person, and he's totally front of office focused. They don't even have a sales team. You know, they have 400 people. It's a pretty big operation. I will say what's really interesting about you talking about manual stuff is they're all manual, you know, paper, moving things, copying this into there. This VA does that, move this around. Like, so pretty manual process, I'd say, that from what I'd seen, just because, you know, there's nothing there to help them do what they want, and it's a pretty complex operation. He's totally focused on being very high level. Now, there's another shop that we've been to, that you guys have been to as well, which I won't say the name, but very on the floor, like very floor focused, really loves screen printing clearly, and is on there buying new equipment, trying to optimize, you know, walking around all the time, very operational focused, and loves the printing aspect. And they have a more of a sales team. Now, granted, he also though knows high level. He's able to like zoom in and out very well, and he can be high level, knows KPIs and numbers, and be able to do sales there, and then also likes going to the floor and doing that because he, you know, he loves the art of screen printing too. But what they have in common is they're both amazing business people. Like, they know how to leverage debt if they need. They know how to work with salespeople. They know how to motivate people. They know how to drive KPIs. They know how to get people together, like 100%. And then the hobbyist-esque side of it is, you know, whether they like screen printing or not, or other aspects, but very KPI driven. I mean, it's like they're basically running traction for the most part, and making sure that the numbers are all lining up, because their costs are so astronomical. Like, their overhead is like insane. We're talking millions of dollars, right? And the margin gets skinnier, and it's hard to really squeeze out. The real way to squeeze out more profit for them is we got to get more efficient. So it's kind of fascinating. Just to quickly pivot, actually, this article came up, and I thought this related more to you, Steven, in promomarketing.com, talking about how college athletes are gearing up for merchandise after the NCAA ruling. The ruling, I read a little bit more about it, watched a couple of videos. It's a little bit confusing, but basically it's stating that athletes can sell their image and or likeness. But, you know, there's a weird question of the compensation, but it sounds like it's related to that they can sell the aspect of them being an athlete, which they couldn't do before. You obviously being on college campuses, what kind of business opportunity, or I know immediately when this happened, students' minds like, you know, exploding. Where do I sell? Where do I get in? What do I do? What's your thoughts on this? What are you guys planning with this?
Yeah, so we've been working on this for quite some time. So name, image, and likeness is essentially the ability to monetize if you're an athlete. It could be an autograph signing. It could be an endorsement. It could be a shoe deal. It could also be merch, right? Now, the one caveat is that you can't use their name, image, and likeness in congruence with the marks of the school they play at. So, for instance, we're at Illinois. I can't use one of the player, you know, say a player wants to monetize and sell his jersey. He can't do that right now, today. So what we've done is we've actually been working with several players and actually signing them, working on contracts. We've got attorneys working on it to create brands for them. Essentially, they have a target audience. They have a market, and we are going to help them co-market and sell merch through limited releases, through drops, through a lot of the Shopify branding that we're doing. And we actually, on Friday, we have like a tour day at the shop. We're bringing players in. Their parents are coming in. A lot of them don't have agents and things like that. So we're just helping them a lot with the process. And then also protecting them in the sense that making sure we do our due diligence, because they can get in a lot of trouble if they don't report something correctly and if they, you know, do something wrong. So I'm spending a lot of time. My business partner was at the press conference with the university, meeting with the athletic directors, just making sure we were all on the same page. And since we've done it, we've now started to be hit up from different influencer level, like athletes from across the country. So we've probably got a dozen or so we're working on right now. Can't announce them yet, but we'll be releasing that soon. So yeah, it fits our niche. It fits our target audience. It's what we do. It's all e-commerce. I don't know. Doesn't seem too hard for us.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, it makes total sense. You've got, you know, like the Tiger Woods logo, right? And that's their branding, and they push that. You got Tom Brady's thing, and Marshall Lynch, I think, has that. They're talking about beast mode gear, which they sell. Like, why couldn't you know, anybody else create their logo and start selling it?
Yeah, I think a lot of the conversations I've been having with them has been, hey, I know you have an audience, but we really need this to pop off. And so that's where Adam, like my business partner, really comes into the picture and is very good at like creative marketing with influencers, and really laying out a plan. If we want this to drop, this is how it's going to go. We've got to do a photo shoot ahead of time. We have to go on Instagram Live. You know, it's not, you know, the shirt is the last part of the equation.
You got to like train them to like market themselves. Cause a lot of times they might be really good athletes, but that's all they can really do. Right. So you're giving them an opportunity, but you're also having to really invest time, energy, and effort, and really probably not only train them, but just run it for them. But
correct.
That's where you don't have the name, they do, but you get to split the revenue with them just because you're going to be doing
so
all that heavy lifting.
Is it like an agency model type where, you know, where it's like 15% of whatever sold we're taking? Because you are upfronting a lot of work here. I mean, listing all of that stuff and guiding them, and, you know, it is...
Handled.
It's a significant upfront load.
Yeah, I mean, we know what happens when we lean into a good influencer. An influencer is not going to put up much money because there's a lot of people out there that'll do it. What's going to make a difference is all the stuff besides the t-shirt. And so that's where we leverage a lot of our creative resources, and we stimulate and we create business out of it, and we make money on the backside. And that's just the gamble that I take. We're working on contracts, that it is like a 12-month deal, that, you know, this is how many releases we want to do. These are what we want to hit. There's a lot of little things that I'm trying to just make sure we double check, before we really dig into it. But, you know, if someone comes to me and says, I have 50,000 followers, I'm going to figure out how to sell merch with them.
Totally. Don't sleep on the influencers. That's for sure.
Before I do the PTO. You know, we have TikTokers that we work with that have a couple million followers, and it just like, you just have to work with them. It's not that bad. And the cool part is you don't know where it's going to pop off. And Matt, mm-hmm. you might know this from Second City, but mm-hmm. one influencer leads to another influencer, and you don't know where you hit gold. And some of those orders go crazy overnight. And Matt can speak a little bit to that.
Yeah, at Second City, I mean, Stevie, he's still got a different model than I've ever seen, but he was heavy into the YouTube content and had YouTubers, and I had never even heard of these people. I mean, granted, I'm in my mid-30s. I'm not watching YouTube content like 12-year-olds are, but these people are like, who the hell are these people? And you'd go look, and they'd have, like, one day they'd have 5 million followers, and, like, you'd look a week later, they'd have 15 million followers. Before you know it, you're printing the same damn shirt week in, week out. You're like, oh, there's 25,000 shirts I have to get out in a week? They have 5 print locations. Oh my God. Okay. The next, you get those done. The next week you got 50,000. You got to get those done. And before you know it, you've got a 10, 20, $30 million client that is just a YouTuber. Right.
I didn't see it coming.
And it's crazy to think that that's what happened.
And shops will ask me, like, do you charge them to build the store? No, I don't charge them to build the store. Because I live for the when they pop off, you know. I create a zero friction when working with influencers. Make it as easy as possible. Get them to trust us. And once they trust us and we put money into their pockets, they're here for the team. You know,
and they hopefully won't go anywhere when they do pop, right? Because that's how you do it. If you're kind of a pain in the ass with them and you're kind of working with them, kind of helping them out, and they pop, they're gonna go, okay, well, I got enough money to pay a bigger corporation to do this and do all the work for me. I got to move on. Right. But if you're hand holding the entire process, yeah, there's a return on that investment, and maybe out of every 30 you have one pops, but that one pop might be massive enough to make it worth all that, and they're not gonna go anywhere when they do get that big. I mean, that happens in the music industry all the time. You see that where small time labels, and they're diehard with their print shop, and that print shop is living on that one basket, right? And then they get signed. They get a 360 deal where a big name corporation takes over everything they get. They have to take their merch, everything. The band can choose not to do that. They can argue out of it, but why would they when that big corporation is going to pay for everything and do the work for them, right?
Right.
So
they don't care.
It happens all the time. So I think you're in the right model of we're going to foster them, grow them. I mean, these college athletes, this is a big thing. There's a percentage of them that are going to make it to the big leagues, right? They're going to go pro. you might have the opportunity to hold on to a couple of those pro players that are going to have massive, massive merch stores then. So you're definitely
and
watching
with some,
them now.
With some of them, I'm like, hey, they're getting a Printavo merch store. No thrills. It's just going to be simple. We're going to pop it up and down and just drop it for a couple of days. And that's it, right? And for some of the ones that I believe in a little bit more, yeah, I'll build them a custom website. I might put a couple thousand dollars into it, you know? That's the kind of gamble you have to play into a little bit, especially in 2021. Yeah. Bruce, are you guys seeing a spike in merch still with like back to school?
It slows down a little bit during the summer because it is so school and organization focused. But yeah, I mean, my guess is just like last year, it'll start to ramp up. Although last year's sales cycles were all over the board, but I'm sure in the fall, it's definitely going
to. I'm seeing more people start to want to sign up for merch, though, at least on my calls throughout the days.
To be honest with you, I would say 2/3 of shops, if not more, do not run stores regularly. You know, I think more were during COVID, and then they now are sort of getting back to what they're used to, which is just, you know, taking in wholesale orders and pumping them out and doing a killer job there. But yeah, I mean, as a sales cycle, it was like, it's, you know, this is different. I mean, it's a new sales channel, right? So if you had to learn, let's say you were all inbound sales and then now you're trying to be outbound sales. Well, of course the first 3 months are going to suck and not work. And like, you know, you don't have anything, you don't have sales scripts, you don't have what to say, you don't have like good process, you don't have anything. And so it's easy to revert back to saying, oh, okay, inbound's going good again. We don't need outbound anymore.
I think it's such a good and simple way to like get started, though. I'll talk to shops and they're like, oh, $100 a month for it. I don't know. I'm like, do you run a t-shirt shop? You're telling me you can't sell $100 worth of t-shirts in a month to pay for that store? And when I put it like that, they're always like, well, yeah. I'm like, try, right? Simple thing that I did for my shop, Sound and Fury, is I was like, man, we don't have any shop shirts. Like, what the hell? Like, we've years of printing. We've got like shirts that I'll wear, like branded shirts, right? For like our brand. We didn't have shop shirts. Like, there's no reason that every 4 to 5 weeks we can't have a design, a shop shirt, put it on the merch store and sell a few to cover that merch store. We started doing it a couple months ago. It's more than covering the cost of the merch store every month. And it's fun. I get to like every 4 to 5 weeks, print 20, 30 shop shirts, give them to friends, give them to you, right? Sell them online. I got friends that are actually buying them online too, which is awesome. It's just a simple thing. And it actually, if you're not already doing some sort of online sale, I think the merch store is like the prime opportunity at a low cost to get into it, right? I mean, sure, you can go to Shopify, $30 per store, but there's a lot of setup, a lot that goes into that. It has its purpose, but I think a merch store at $100 a month, if you're printing goods and you run a store and you can't cover $100 of sales of t-shirts in a month to make up for that store, you should probably think a little bit harder about what you're doing, because it's when people are like, oh, $100 a month, I'm like, what, you can't afford that? Come on. You're running a business. $100 a month should be nothing. And then to have the opportunity to have more than that, have lots of stores going. Also, why not put a couple 1-2 color shirts up, make some screen printed heat transfers. If they sell, they sell. If they don't, they don't. You're not really out anything, right? You spent 20 minutes and you printed 20 transfers. And when a sale comes through, you transfer it, you ship it. I think more people are starting to get into that now. So I'm seeing a lot more in my day-to-day, people starting to get into merch. Maybe it's not the prime time to be using it because school's not in session, but they're kind of finally catching on, like, okay, there's a chance I could wake up in the morning with $20 more, $40 more. It's worth it, right? It's worth putting it up there and just seeing, promoting it, learning how to market that, go on Facebook, go to Instagram, start sharing those things. Maybe you can't be Steven's shop quite yet and be running all these great merch stores, but you got to start somewhere, right? It is 2021.
We started our stores with Google online stores. Google.
Ooh,
Google,
not the
merch.
Yahoo. Yahoo had one too.
And then Store Envy for a little bit. I used everyone in the planet.
Big Cartel.
I did a PayPal store at one point. I should have bought Shopify stock like 10 years ago. But
yeah, we all
that's
should.
Okay. that
is
okay.
On a tear right now. Got a really good question for Ask Anything today. You guys can email in podcast@printavo.com and we will research it. We will get back to you and we will bring it up during the show. This week's question is more about doing more with less. obviously hiring is difficult. There's benefits that are from COVID till mid-September, and people are having trouble hiring, you know, constantly. Other people I hear is just saying, hey, I post a job post. I used to get a bunch of applications. I get nothing. It's crickets, which is kind of funny in a satirical way, because you just get so excited to, you can afford to bring somebody else on and then nobody applies. But how do we turn this around and make it a positive thing, or just be more efficient with what you have? I got to imagine both of you guys, Matt, you know, obviously when you got stripped down during COVID, I'm sure you've got good things. Farrick, I'm sure you've got really good things too. I'm just curious on your thoughts. You've got sales, art, production, post-production, everything.
Matt texted us this morning, you could probably eat while you poop.
I'm not going to read the text that Steven had sent, because they were way more appropriate than that.
You could do more with less. there's a lot you can do. You can hire GraphX for your art department so that you can automate your entire art department. And I promise you, you'll never look back.
I want to pause there for a second, because that is such a massive thing that people still don't seem to know exists, right? You need an artist. You need to make mock-ups. You need to make separations. You need to make proofs. You have to do this. That's usually a body at a computer. Sometimes it's the same body at a computer, small shop. They're at the computer and they're on press and they're in the dark room, right? If you can't find somebody to hire right now because they're getting benefits from the government, you can't afford what they want, there are entire systems, GraphicSource, that has those remote people doing it for you, right? You can pay less than you're going to pay to have somebody in your building and have about the same experience. They're going to have a pretty good batting average. Some things will be good. Some things won't be as good. You'll have to go back to the drawing board, make adjustments to the SEPs, get back to press, make a new screen. But you have a body without having to have a body. That one right there is massive. And I get hit up at least two times a week asking, like, hey, where do I find a good separator? I'm trying to bring somebody in-house. I mean, you're going to have a hell of a time trying to do that right now, right? Because you can't hire anybody at the moment. And they have to train them. I'm not saying get rid of in-house artists. I don't want all my art friends to be like, you're trying to take my job away from me. But you can have one in-house artist that kind of like manages that flow and get a lot more done, which normally would take 2 to 3 artists to have done in your art department.
It's a production artist. It's a production artist. It's someone to vector. It's someone to redraw. It's someone to digitize, do all the nasty proofs, you know, the simple steps that are just like just clogging up your inbox. And then it allows your artist to actually be a creative. Right.
What is it? How does that process work in your Printavo account and everything, like the back and forth with them?
So I've been with GraphX for a year and change now, and we've got Jeannie on our team. She's on Skype with us where she works 9 to 5. We can talk to her whenever we want. I can tell her to stop doing something and do something else if need be. But every action is listed in Printavo. So I need you to vector this, and there'll be like a checklist for, hey, revector this, upload it, change the status. I need this digitized, go in, digitize it, upload it, change the status to complete. Proofs, mock-ups, SEPs, same way. For us, it's very linear. I've seen other shops do it with tasks, mm-hmm. but it's just call and response. The crazy part is the speed. I mean, let's just put it out there that we're talking like hours for SEPs. Like, you put in a request at 9 a.m., by 10 a.m., it's SEPed, and you're like, whoa, that's done. Art used to be a bottleneck in our shop, and it's now like completely automated, and we are never looking back. A lot
of what I've been doing with shops too, because I work with a lot of shops that are new to Printavo, or maybe have been on Printavo, they're getting into GraphX, and I'm trying to work on standardizing that process. I've been working with GraphX actually on that exactly.
Go ahead.
I was saying we're doing a lot more task oriented, just because when we release the automations that can apply tasks, and if task lists are completed, having those triggers, a lot of the shops, I wasn't necessarily a fan of having people have to finagle your statuses if they're not kind of worthy of finagling your statuses.
Matt thinks his Printavo runs better than mine.
I don't think, Steven, I know. I'm just kidding.
The duel.
No, I don't. You want to lose your mind, go look at Steven's Printavo. That's how you know his brain's bigger than mine, because he actually can keep track of all of it. I look at it and go, what? I start drooling. I lose an eye. It goes cross-eyed. But we started going a lot more task oriented, and you just literally make that graphics employee, the user, a user on your Printavo. So as it's going through, okay, this has to be vectorized, add that task. This has to be redrawn, add that task. This has to be sept, add that task. And it goes by the date you put. So now they've got a task list at all times. You can use the function in my account where it says, email me if tasks do that day, or email me when tasks are assigned. So you can automatically be emailing them to know you have a new task, and they just log in their Printavo account. They see their task, they do it, they upload, they follow directions. Like you said, Stephen, having very clear call to actions. Now you can have them doing stuff
much, much
faster. What about
art approvals? Do they create that and send it and then handle changes? Or
in my shop, they upload, and then our basically production coordinator flips a status to send it to the customer just as a QC. We probably could bypass that now, but it's routine.
Just
and
in honest, case, yeah.
Myla just goes through and goes, boop, send a customer, send a customer, send a customer.
Got
boop,
it.
I don't like that left chest. Flip it back. So she has a redo button in there. And if something's hot on press, they're on Skype with us. And there's sometimes where I'll video chat and be like, hey guys, can you tell me the order of this? If for some reason it's not printing right. And Rob might say, ooh, put that on head two. Be like, okay, got it. Thank you. So it's just like having this like brain surgeons who are all artists and production artists like in your back pocket at all times.
Right.
And I know
supercharge
your arts department. So yeah. let's keep going. What are other things you can do with less? Matt, I gave GraphX. You're up next.
I mean, this is kind of a low hanging fruit, but an obvious one that is a big, big one is using automations. When I first got into doing Zapier and things like that, I was watching Steven's YouTube video on how to make that Google review one. That's a simple, low-hanging fruit that has massive, massive help. Since I started doing that, Stephen, we've been averaging 2 to 3 5-star reviews a week. We didn't even have any Google reviews before I started doing that because I didn't like it. I didn't like being like, let me go ask for a review. Let me feel awkward about doing this. Let me remember to actually email them. Now on a job's putting job complete, it's following that exact zap line, and we've been getting a lot more business. The amount of business we get now saying, oh, I found you on Google. We get one or two of those a week when that never existed. It was always word of mouth or like a friend I had or like return business. We're getting new business from local small businesses as well. We did a job for a bakery recently. And it was like a whim. They're like, oh, we want some shirts. They say flour on them. We ended up doing like a couple hundred shirts with like flour, butter, a bunch of different. They were awesome shirts. And that was all from them finding us on Google. So little automations, Zapier is a big one. Going to like art approvals, things like that too. The built-in automations in Printavo. I just revamped this for Sound and Fury too, because I was finding that a lot of times it'd be like a little change on like art approval out. They'd email back, oh, this looks great. Can you change just one little thing? Well, I didn't have an automation to then status change notification again back. I was having to like, okay, email, here you go. It's like, wow, I do this 3-4 times a week. It only takes 3-4 minutes every time I do it, but I'm doing it a lot. Why don't I just go ahead and make a new status that's like revised art approval, triggers a new email. All I got to do is go make those changes, upload that new mockup, click a button and move. Right, so those little things where you might not think, oh, it doesn't take that much time. It's a couple minutes here and there. That shit adds up, right? A couple minutes here and there definitely adds up throughout the week and starts to be a lot more. So
I got one.
Any repetitive things that you're doing that you can automate, you got to try to automate.
I'll give another one. A lot of customer education early in the sales process, right? So we made a 1-minute YouTube video on ordering from Campus Inc. And it's if you're just getting started, and I do like a buzz through in 1 minute of like, here are how prices are going to work. Here are our turnaround times. Here are the things we offer. Like I just do, you know, like when you hop on a plane and watch your 1 minute thing of United, we have that now. And in every status on Printavo where the customer is getting notified, it's always telling them what's next. And I stole that from Sticker Mule. We'll say, hey, the first step of the process is the order approval. Once you hit approve, you're going to be getting an art approval in 2 to 3 days. You know, if you don't get that, please reach out to us or make sure you check your spam filter or something like that, you know? And so I just keep them very engaged so that they're just like handheld through the process. So it lowers the amount of communication that we have to do and so much back and forth with our customer. And it feels like they're ordering Domino's pizza. I think our team likes that a lot more because they're not necessarily like, we're not doing email overkill, you know, and we do that by using Front and Slack and obviously Printavo automations, but educating the customer through the process. It took probably like a day for me to sit through and make all of them. Game changer for us when it talks about the ordering process.
You talked about standardizing. One of the five S's in 2 Second Lean is standardize best practices, labeling things. Fair. I know you've got a lot of stuff on the floor and stickers, and like I've seen Brett when I was at Printed Threads, they have like align the carts on the floor here. Like literally, this is press one's stack of shirts, next stack of shirts, and it's like in a like an aisle. It's literally an aisle on the floor that says that. I mean, are there other things that you've put on the floor too, or labeled?
How to zero out your press, or like how to turn knobs, or
oh, your knob one is genius. Not enough shops do that too to help train people. That's a
yeah.
What the micro adjustments actually do? He's got them on the press. So we turn this way, it goes this direction. Turn this way, it goes this direction. Everything.
I always mess it up. Yeah, and then the other one was like, what are the 8 maintenance steps for the press every single time? You know, you have to grease this, the zerk fittings, the whatever. And so when Wally came down and Matt came down, I was like, label them all out. We typed them up, we printed them, put them on the floor, and now we know what maintenance is for each machine. Just little things like that, you know?
There's a quick video before we wrap up that I saw where he said, take your revenue and divide it by 2,000 hours you work, and that is the time that your hourly cost, like how much you're worth. So, you know, if you're a $500,000 business, you are $250 an hour employee. So if you're doing something that somebody else should be doing that's a $10 an hour employee, then you are literally costing yourself $240 per hour, roughly, right? Which definitely, I think, makes you rethink about your whole day a lot of times. Like, what the hell am I doing?
I got to get off this podcast. I got work to do.
I got a 10 o'clock.
Right. Heck yeah. Well, awesome. Guys, write in podcast@printavo.com with your questions. We'd love to be able to answer them. Thank you guys so much for being able to join. We're always trying to make this episode a little bit better and more helpful for you to be able to grow your business. I'm Bruce from Printavo. We will see you guys again next Thursday.